Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, this is show 54, and this is going to be a fast-moving show, meaning it's dated quickly. This show is being recorded Friday, March 20th, in an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den in my house as I shelter in. Okay, and remember to stay tuned later in the show as I will give a local report based on an interview today with our local health commissioner of the Toledo Lucas County Health Department. First, I'd like to give some kudos. I am very proud to be an Ohioan today. I have been very impressed by the leadership of Government Mike DeWine, both what it means directly for us as Ohioans in this state, and also providing leadership to other governors and leaders from federal, state, and municipalities around the country. On the other hand, we still have the Don, Mr. Trump, aka our president, still seems fixated on listing this virus as a Chinese virus and playing this blame game. This is not helpful. Public health needs to be non-judgmental and soberly based on the facts. And of course, he continues to give multiple conflicting messages on multiple fronts. Okay, but here we're about science. So I'd like to do just three articles to get us going, to set up what we're dealing about, and then I will have some commentary about our national situation and get to that local report, find out what's happening in our county today. Okay, first up, this from ABC News. This is from Tom Bossert, who is a former Homeland Security advisor to Trump. Part of the reason why I'm doing this is because there's a lot of partisan stuff being thrown around, and we want to take somebody from the Trump circle to actually give you some information. So this is his piece called The Coronavirus Paradox, Our Lowest Point and Finest Hour. The paradox of the novel coronavirus response is that it only works if we take aggressive steps before they seem necessary, and if they work, will not have seemed necessary. Success will look like we've overreacted. This is a unique emergency, but the basics still apply. For public officials in a crisis, you tell people everything you know and everything you do not know. Acknowledge uncertainty. Don't overpromise or over-reassure. Share the burden of complex problems and give people something to do. Don't make fun of them for how they feel, whether fearful or skeptical, and tell people how you made your decisions. Admit when you could have done better. And most importantly for leaders, explain to people what the future will hold. So, how did authorities reach a decision to implement these very costly and inconvenient interventions, and why? Public health officials and scientists studied the implementation of non-pharmaceutical interventions for epidemic mitigation in 43 cities in the United States from September 8, 1918 through February 22, 1919, when an influenza outbreak, one that killed 50 million people worldwide, became the last major pandemic to affect the United States. They did this to determine whether city-to-city variations in death rates were associated with the timing, duration, and combination of non-pharmaceutical interventions. They concluded that they were. The key, according to an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, is, quote, early, sustained, and layered application of non-pharmaceutical interventions. The doctors concluded that such measures could potentially provide valuable time for production and distribution of pandemic strain vaccine and antiviral medication. Optimally, appropriate implementation of non-pharmaceutical interventions would decrease the burden on healthcare services and critical infrastructure. The biggest misunderstanding about these interventions is that they are an a la carte menu of options to be selectively implemented. This is dead wrong. They all must be implemented to achieve a layered effect. Removing any one can defeat them all. The trick is to target the closures and cancellations early and aggressively in communities experiencing human-to-human transmission indicative of need, and not in those communities not yet experiencing evidence of virus transmission. So, what does the future hold? Based on the virus's spread and the assumptions of many doctors and epidemiologists, we could see an infection rate of approximately 20 to 30% of the population. That's roughly a range between 66 million and 100 million infected Americans. Remember the paradox of reaction. Let's act like this is correct and hope for less. As the virus peaks over the coming months, remember that fewer cases is proof that all of our efforts have worked. That will not be permission to let down our guard. In fact, China, even Wuhan, is still susceptible to another outbreak, like dry tinder, that could reignite. Wuhan and other controlled areas are only very cautiously reopening. The process is tricky. The goal is to minimize the economic costs of continued interventions while maximizing the preventive health effects of those interventions. Reaching the optimal point achieves slow spread without wrecking the economy. This will be a long game. We will get through this together, at stages exasperated and at stages calm. We are almost certainly in a recession. We will almost certainly need increased imports. Massive government bailouts will be required, with care and bipartisan support. Throughout it all, we will take care of each other, and we will start emerging in the fall with antiviral medications and then later a vaccine. If we work together, this terrible moment could be our finest hour. I certainly hope that's the case. Okay, next up, this a commentary from CNN. And this is an author who has written about Donald Trump and Mike Pence. A terrified nation needs a leader during this crisis, not a salesman. Here we go. A terrified nation in the grip of a pandemic tuned into a White House briefing on Thursday and heard not a sober, confident leader, but a salesman hyping unproven treatments, boasting of non-existent achievements, and offering false hope instead of realistic counsel, stressing words and phrases like rapid, immediate, and game changer. President Trump made it sound as if the magic pills were in the mail and everything would revert back to normal soon. While Trump touted the use of existing drugs being tried on an experimental basis, the Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Stephen Hahn gently but firmly tempered expectations and said he didn't want to offer, quote, false hope, given the additional research that needs to be done. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, made it even clearer at CNN's town hall Thursday. Let's make sure people understand what it is. Today, there is no proven safe and effective therapies for the coronavirus. There's no magic drug out there right now. For weeks, public health officials have been trying to convey accurate information to the American people, while the president continues to spout falsehoods and misinformation. As experts predicted a rising epidemic, the president said, quote, "We're going very substantially down, not up." When they said the worst lay ahead, he said, "It's something we have tremendous control of." Moment by moment, the president has made us less certain and more afraid because we cannot trust what he says. He's in the grip of the I alone can fix it fantasy mindset that he first expressed on the campaign trail in 2016. In the past, the harm caused by this God complex was limited to problems like a government shutdown and damaged alliances. In the face of the COVID-19 pandemic, it has left us dangerously underprepared and has likely cost lives already. Congress should immediately give $100 billion to cities and states to fight coronavirus. At his latest news conference, the president seemed detached from reality as he pitched us on anti-malaria drugs. While early evidence suggests that chloroquine, a drug used to treat malaria and autoimmune diseases, may have some activity against the novel coronavirus, there's not yet sufficient clinical evidence that it is effective. Nevertheless, Trump said, we have a couple therapeutic treatments that we're in really good shape on, and that's for immediate delivery. While Hahn explained the loosening of regulations to allow for compassionate use so doctors can ask for approval to treat seriously ill patients with experimental drugs, he stressed the importance of additional research. He said that's a drug that the president has directed us to take a closer look at as to whether an expanded use approach to that could be done and to actually see if that benefits patients. And again, we want to do that in the setting of a clinical trial, a large, pragmatic clinical trial to actually gather the information. No promises can be made. And CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, later explained, everybody wants to be hopeful, but we've got to exert a little bit of caution when hearing about these types of drugs. They have been trialed like everything else. As the number of confirmed cases in the U.S. has surpassed 11,000 and the death tolls exceeded 150, the need for leadership, not salesmanship, grows more urgent. With many workers laid off, the economy has ground to a halt, and people feel justifiably afraid for their health, their financial security, and for the future. Trump's complete failure of imagination is costing America lives and treasure. History abounds with examples of great leaders facing crises with a strength fortified by truth. Franklin D. Roosevelt confronted the Great Depression, while Prime Minister Winston Churchill countered Adolf Hitler with realism, a sense of responsibility and honesty that inspired confidence. Trump, whose only true skill is salesmanship, is so allergic to responsibility that when asked about the obvious failings of the government's response to the pandemic, said, "I don't take responsibility at all." With these words hanging in the air, the failure to provide test kits and ensure hospitals and healthcare workers have enough equipment has only become more evident by the hour. How can anyone have confidence in his or her government when the leader continues to brag in the face of widespread evidence of incompetence? Moments after Trump boasted about his efforts and shared how proud he is of his own performance, CNN presented an emergency room doctor in Rhode Island who talked about her hospital facing shortage of basic supplies. "We cannot get the masks and other protective gear that we need," said Dr. Megan Ranney. Meanwhile, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has advised healthcare professionals to use bandanas or scarves as a last resort if masks are not available. It must be noted that a competent government would have stockpiled protective masks and gowns and even respirators to prepare for a pandemic some experts have warned us about for years. Someone is responsible for this very basic failure, and any other president would face the reality and own the problem. By refusing to take responsibility for such a colossal failure while simultaneously trying to drag us into his delusions, Trump is proving that he never was and perhaps never will be up to fulfilling his responsibilities as president. The time has come to recognize Trump's deficiencies and tune him out. Governors like Andrew Cuomo of New York are stepping up into the leadership vacuum, delivering realistic assessments of the crisis, recognizing the human toll, and counseling patients. Other governors, mayors, and public health leaders have shown similar grace under fire. They have nothing to sell and plenty to offer when it comes to empathy and resolve. Let their voices be heard. Okay, in the last article, getting back to more solid science here, purely science, this from popularresistance.org. World Health Organization expert explains why China's cases of COVID-19 have declined. It's all about speed, the most important lessons from China's COVID-19 response. There's one country in the world that currently has the most knowledge of and experience with COVID-19, China. It's now critical that the rest of the world learn as much as it can from China's efforts to respond to and limit the spread of the virus. That was precisely the intention of a recent World Health Organization mission to China, led by the agency's Assistant Director General and veteran epidemiologist Bruce Alluard. Its major finding? China's bold approach to contain the rapid spread of this new respiratory pathogen has changed the course of a rapidly escalating and deadly epidemic. Vox talked to Alluard about the big takeaways from the mission's report, the playbook China used to curb COVID-19 spread, why speed in responding to an outbreak is so crucial, whether we can trust China's data, and why smoking could be exacerbating the impact of the epidemic here. So what the world can learn from China's COVID-19 response? This will be a question-answer format. Question. The World Health Organization has been suggesting the world should follow China's lead, but as you know, there are concerns about the human rights effects from China's response to the COVID-19 outbreak, most notably the restrictions on freedom of movement through lockdowns and cordon sanitaires, that's large quarantines. How do you respond to critics who are concerned about that? Bruce Alloward. I think people aren't paying close enough attention. The majority of the response in China, in 30 provinces, was about case finding, contact tracing, and suspension of public gatherings, all common measures used anywhere in the world to manage the spread of diseases. The lockdown people are referring to, the human rights concerns, usually reflected the situation in places like Wuhan, the city in Hubei province where the virus was first detected. The lockdown was concentrated in Wuhan and two or three other cities that also exploded with COVID-19 cases. These are places that got out of control in the beginning of the outbreak, and China made this decision to protect China and the rest of the world. China is now trying to restart its economy. They can't do that with millions of people in lockdown in their apartments or with the trains stopped or all their factories suspended. They're getting those things working again, but they have their systems primed for rapid detection and rapid response. They never want to be in another situation like Wuhan, and they haven't. That's the first place, and 30 other provinces managed to avoid that. And not just avoid that, but reverse the outbreak. Okay, so most of the measures used in China to stop the virus were traditional public health moves that are broadly accepted, and the draconian measures were rare. Is there any sense of what in China's toolkit was most effective? I think the key learning from China is speed. It's all about the speed. The faster you can find the cases, isolate the cases, and track their close contacts, the more successful you're going to be. Another big takeaway is that even when you have substantial transmission with a lot of clusters, because people are looking at the situation in some countries now and going, oh gosh, what can be done? What China demonstrates is if you settle down, roll up your sleeves, and begin that systematic work of case finding and contact tracing, you can definitely change the shape of the outbreak, take the heat out of it, and prevent a lot of people from getting sick and a lot of the most vulnerable from dying. The situation becomes then, how do they do that? And how much of it is replicable? Since coming back from China, everybody I talk to begins with, we can't lock down a city of 15 people like China. I say, why would you ever want to? And I ask, does your population know X, Y, and Z about the virus? I learn they haven't started with the basics. So, number one, if you want to get speed of response, your population has to know this disease. You find any population in the West and ask them what are the two presenting signs you have to be alerted to, what would they say? Aren't the two initial symptoms most commonly fever and dry cough? Right, but many still think it's a runny nose and cold, and I will note at today's conference with President Trump, he cited a runny nose and sneezing. As signs of infection. Okay, back on with the interview. Your population is your surveillance system. Everybody has got a smartphone. Everybody can get a thermometer. That is your surveillance system. Don't rely on this hitting your health system because then it's going to infect it. You got this great surveillance system out there. Make sure the surveillance system is primed. Make sure you're ready to act on the signals that come in from that surveillance system. You've got to be set up to rapidly assess whether or not they really have these symptoms. Test those people, and if necessary, isolate and trace their contacts. Here again is where I've seen things starting to break down. What I've been told is if you think you've been exposed and have a fever, call your general practitioner. We've got to be better than that. If we are going to use general practitioners, do they have an emergency line where they can get through? Do they know what to do? In China, they have set up a giant network of fever hospitals. In some areas, a team can go to you and swab you and have an answer for you in 4 to 7 hours. But you've got to be set up. Speed is everything. So make sure your people know about the virus. Make sure you have mechanisms for working with them very quickly through your health system. Then enough public health infrastructure to investigate cases, identify the close contacts, and then make sure they remain under surveillance. That's 90% of the Chinese response. But again, China implemented so many different measures at once. How do we know contact tracing was more important than, say, the mass cordon sanitaire and shutting down cities? Think about the virus. Where is the virus and how do you contain the virus? You know the virus is in the cases and in the close contacts. That's where the majority of the virus is. That's where the majority of the focus should be. China did a whole bunch of things, and other countries may have to do them too as they go forward. But the key is public information and having an informed population, finding those cases, rapidly isolating them. The faster you isolate them is what breaks the chain. Making sure close contacts are quarantined and monitored until you know if they're infected. Somewhere between 5 and 15% of those contacts are infected. And again, it's those close contacts, not everyone. There were reports from China about collateral damage from this outbreak. The HIV patients, for example, who are reportedly not getting treatment in time because of travel restrictions and lockdowns. What can we learn from China to minimize this type of damage in other countries? China took a whole bunch of steps that they realized they had to repurpose big chunks of their hospital systems to respond to the outbreak. The first thing is, they said testing is free. Treatment is free. Right now, there are huge barriers to testing and treatment in the West. You can get tested, but then you might be negative and have to foot the bill. In China, they realized those were barriers to people seeking care. So as a state, they took over the payments for people whose insurance plans didn't cover them. They tried to mitigate those barriers. The other thing they did, normally a prescription in China can't last for more than a month, but they increased it to 3 months to make sure people didn't run out when they had to close a lot of their hospitals. Another thing, prescriptions could be done online and through WeChat instead of requiring a doctor appointment, and they set up a delivery system for medications for affected populations. The idea that your spread of this virus is driven mainly by families features prominently in your report. How do we know that? You look at a big long list of all the cases and identify those where you have clusterings in space and time and try to investigate what kind of clustering happened. Was it in a hospital, an old age home, theaters, restaurants? We found it was predominantly families. It's not a big surprise. China had shut down a lot of the other ways people could gather, and family clusters were the closest, longest exposures to the virus. And getting the virus is a function of whether someone's got it, how long they're exposed, and how much virus they are shedding. More of a surprise, and this is something we still don't understand, is how little virus there was in the much broader community. Everywhere we went, we tried to find and understand how many tests had been done, how many people were tested, and who they were. In Guangdong province, for example, there were 320,000 tests done in people coming to fever clinics, outpatient clinics. And at the peak of the outbreak, 0.47% of those tests were positive. People kept saying that the cases are the tip of the iceberg, but we couldn't find that. We found there's a lot of people who are cases, a lot of close contacts, but not a lot of asymptomatic circulation of this virus in the bigger population. And that's different from flu. In flu, you'll find this virus right through the child population, right through blood samples of 20 to 40% of the population. If you didn't find the iceberg of mild cases in China, what does this say about how deadly the virus is, the case fatality rate? It says you're probably not way off. The average case fatality rate is 3.8% in China. But a lot of that is driven by the early epidemic in Wuhan, where the numbers were higher. If you look outside the Hubei province, where Wuhan is, the case fatality rate is just under 1% now. I would not quote that as the number. That's the mortality in China, and they find cases fast, get them isolated, in treatment, and supported early. Second thing they do is ventilate dozens in the average hospital. They use extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is removing blood from a person's body and oxygenating their red blood cells when ventilation doesn't work. This is sophisticated healthcare. They have a survival rate for this disease I would not extrapolate to the rest of the world. What you've seen in Italy and Iran is a lot of people are dying. This suggests the Chinese are really good at keeping people alive with this disease. And just because it's 1% in the general population outside of Wuhan doesn't mean it will be the same in other countries. That's really concerning for the rest of the world. Are you suggesting this is the big one, the once a century pandemic people have been bracing for? It's not. It can be the big one, like flu. For flu, whether you have a pandemic with flu, it's a function of the virus. That's a virus with very, very high infectivity rate, a very, very high transmissibility rate. The time the virus takes to go from one person to the next can be as short as 1.5 days. For COVID-19, it's longer, 4 or 5 days. Look around the world. We're seeing a whole bunch of outbreaks controlled with the right responses and even turned around if they get into a bad state. Panic and hysteria are not appropriate. This is a disease that is in the cases and their close contacts. It's not hidden enemy lurking behind bushes. Get organized, get educated, get working. Can we trust China's data? The big question is, are they hiding things? No, they are not. We looked at many different things to try to corroborate the cases are dropping. when I went to fever clinics and talked to people working, they'd say, we used to have a line out the door. Now we see a case once per hour. According to the national data, fever clinics went from seeing 46,000 people per day at one point, and it's now down to 1,000. So there's been a huge drop in numbers into the feeder system. Second thing, when talking to physicians in hospitals, I heard again and again that we have open beds. We can get people isolated even more rapidly. I heard that in Wuhan and other provinces. The third thing, I talked to people running clinical trials of drugs, and they are having a problem recruiting patients. All of these things help to corroborate China's data. What were the biggest vulnerabilities in China, and what are you most worried about for other countries as they face more cases? You have to have enough beds. In China, they closed off whole wings of hospitals, sealed them to make them a dirty zone where patients with the disease could be treated safely. They worked at scale. They bought a heap of ventilators to keep people alive. They made sure they had a lot of high-flow oxygen, CT scanning capacity, lab capacity. So beds, ventilators, oxygen, CTs, and labs. And they had problems with all of those supplies at different points. The Chinese will say there are shortcomings in their response, in how fast we found this, how fast we responded, and there will be major reform to address that. While deaths are occurring at higher rates in elderly people, there have been reports of young, otherwise healthy people dying too. What's going on there, and is there any talk of how China's high smoking rates may be contributing to these deaths? Smoking definitely does because the comorbid conditions make COVID-19 worse. Over the long term, we know smokers get cardiovascular and lung disease, and these are all cofactors in terms of higher probability of mortality. From that perspective, we know it's a problem. In some of the mortality research, we see a higher mortality rate in males than females in China. There's a suspicion that may be a function of differences in smoking patterns. There's a very high smoking rate among men in China compared to women. What are other important knowledge gaps? It's hard to find the virus in general swabs done in the community, and that's interesting and reassuring. It's not like flu, but we couldn't answer the question of why some young, otherwise healthy people suddenly deteriorate. We need to understand that if we want to keep people alive. In the elderly, what explains the high death rate? Is it something about deterioration of the immune system with age, or the higher probability of you having of developing other illnesses as you age? I think it's the latter. These people are dying of an inflammatory process in their lungs. It's not an infectious process like a bacterial or viral infection. It's inflammatory, like we saw with SARS. We're not sure of the mechanism. We do know the proportion of people who die who had cancer was half compared to hypertension and cardiovascular disease. Diabetes is a little bit lower than those two, and cancer lower again. Okay, so where are we today in the United States of America with this epidemic and pandemic? I would argue that the gold standard and what we should be looking for is sheltering in place nationally. And by shelter in place, what I mean by this is like in Italy, with minimal outside contact except for essential workers, such as health workers, food system workers, many transportation workers, first responders, and basic services such as utilities and trash pickup. We're nowhere near that. We are two places, large places in this country that are close to that is New York and California today as of Friday, March 20th. Hopefully that'll change quickly. But the rest of the country is at a hodgepodge of states of alert and states of restriction, whether those restrictions are voluntary or mandated. We know right now that testing is woefully inadequate, likely for weeks more. Testing seems to be targeted by regions most affected and further limited by those that are most symptomatic, basically requiring serious health care. We know that there are supply chain shortages that are affecting testing, whether that's swabs or reagents or these full test kits that are more or less self-contained. Oddly, when I did a search online for a lot of news stories regarding these kind of like, drive-through testing and that type of thing, there's a lot of what I would call kind of partisan testing, meaning that the testing is only available for somebody who's in that health system or has a certain insurance carrier, and even some places are charging for testing. This is not the way that we should be responding to a full-scale public health emergency. Now, our contract tracing, in other words, when you identify a positive and you identify the people that those people came in contact with closely or casually, our contact tracing capacity is marginal and will likely be overwhelmed long before we reach a level of testing that's needed right now. So where do I see this going? I think in the U.S., unless things change really, really quickly and we get pretty much a national shelter-in-place order, we're going to see multi-epicenters in a rolling epidemic by region, by state. And it's going to be like this hydra where you're fighting, you know, we're fighting in New York and then maybe we throw our resources and testing there, but, you know, we'll turn around and then two or three other places. It's just going to keep rolling out until we really deal with the entire nation as a whole. And the reality is the crisis of the lack of adequate testing now, it's crippled our early response. This has not been helped by having very disparate leadership at the national, state, and local levels. This has really hampered a fully coordinated response. Another big thing to look at, of course, is kind of the health economy nexus. You see this epidemic really talked about in two ways. One, the actual health effects of the epidemic, and then two, the effects on the economy. Where these two things really meet may determine a lot of where we go in the future. Workers without adequate sick leave, no significant financial reserves, will feed us back into a problematic situation where workers are going to work while symptomatic because they feel that they're driven to that out of economic necessity. Hopefully, we will get, it looks like there's a lot of things happening in Congress. Hopefully, they'll happen very quickly on a large, large scale. Okay, there's also been talk of like drugs that maybe could be available relatively soon to help mitigate some of the effects, particularly of people who have serious disease. First, I think it's important to understand that we're talking two different things, treatment versus prevention of transmission. These drugs, these antivirals or whatever, are probably going to have little or no effect on actually preventing further transmission. So the social distancing things that we're looking at are going to be needed regardless. The treatment hope would be that if we can find some decent antivirals or something that can help pin down, lower some of the mortality by the serious disease, that's what we can be hopeful. But the thing to look out for that is if that's even possible, then we're going to have to focus very closely on the inequality of access that is baked into our system. We have to make sure that vulnerable populations have access and that it's really going by need, not by socioeconomic status or racial status or whatever. So that's something to look for. Okay, let's get to the local report. I talked to Eric Gudzinski, the health commissioner of the Toledo Lucas County Health Department, today. Most of my questions were around our preparedness and capacity to respond to this epidemic and this pandemic and our local epidemic. Okay, I first asked him about that $8 billion federal legislation that was passed that will aid state and local health departments. What would that do for us and when? There is no word from state or federal officials on what that money will be available for and how much will be available for Lucas County, when that money will be available and specifically what it will be available for. So we're kind of in the dark there. So we're basically on our own with the resources that we have in our community right now today. Okay, testing. What's our status locally here in Lucas County? We have no community available testing due to lack of testing capability. Testing is only in hospitals based on urgent healthcare needs. Further, testing priority will go to health workers and first responders ahead of community patients. We have a backlog of severely limited testing, and this has been getting worse, meaning the time to get test results back has moved from 3 days to 5 days to 7 days. Okay, here's the important quote. This is a direct quote from our local health commissioner. Tests don't mean anything to us now. Tests don't mean anything to us now. I'm going to repeat that a third time. Tests don't mean anything to us now. That basically is underscoring the reality that testing is essentially not available. What we have to do now, that toolbox that we're supposed to layer on of testing and contact tracing and social distancing, we do not have testing and contact tracing. We have social distancing. So we've got to make that work as best as we can. So really, what are we being told? Social distancing is all that we got now? Act as everybody might have the virus. scary but true. And unfortunately, because we don't have these other things to layer on top of it, it becomes a little bit more scary because you have all that more unknown, flying blind, not knowing where viruses and outbreaks are happening either regionally or within a community by contacting those people who've actually tested positive. Okay, contact tracing was something else I was concerned about, sort of made moot by the fact that we don't really have testing. So you can't trace a contact without testing. And the very limited testing doesn't even allow identifying enough positives to fill up the very limited contact tracing capacity that we do have. And when testing is available locally on a community-wide basis for people with symptoms, probably some weeks from now, they expect that there will be so many positives that it will immediately overwhelm their ability to meaningfully trace contacts. So even though we may get testing at some point, the contact tracing, another thing kind of in that triad, testing, contact tracing, and social distancing, the contact tracing will probably be meaningless because we'll be so far to the epidemic and we'll be having so many positives every day that our minimal infrastructure to be able to trace those will be completely overwhelmed. Okay, last thing I asked about was hospital preparedness. He was not aware of current shortages of supplies, but said that hospitals are eager looking for masks and trying to find supply lines, which is pretty much the same situation as most of the rest of the country at this point. Okay, I want to make a couple calls to action. The obvious one is where we are here locally, where we are in, I think, the whole country, is we need to take social distancing measures that you've all heard about extremely seriously. Research these on your own if you're at all uncertain about what that means. A couple other ones. I gave blood last week. I'm a regular blood donor, and I was about due to do it anyways, but I thought I'm going to do this before things get super, super crazy. So donate blood if you can. Another commitment that I'm going to personally make and issue a challenge to all of my listeners is if you should get infected and recover well, please commit to working on the front lines to relieve those who are not immune. Because there's a lot of essential workers in the areas that I listed before that are going to have to continue to work, and nobody on this planet other than the people that have been infected thus far are actually immune to this. So we are all vulnerable, and it's basically the only vaccine we have is already getting this. So if you should get this infection and recover well enough to work well, then please commit to working on the front lines to relieve somebody who is not immune. Okay, folks, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to review this show or previous shows or queue up future shows, feel free to go to toppun.com. That's TOPPUN.com. /blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.